This seminar series is in part preparation for the EPA-ORD Regional Workshop on Cumulative Risk Assessment, being sponsored by the ORD Office of Science Policy and hosted by Region 5 in Chicago, July 28th through 30th, 2009. This seminar series is publicly open in support of advancing cumulative risk assessment, while the workshop itself will be primarily internal to EPA to enhance policy and other deliberative discussions. The website for registration for that workshop should be going live any day now. We will send out a broadcast message about that, or you can write to me, Andrew Geller, or any of the others of us who you may have heard over this time, Matthew Small, Charles Maurice, Patty Tyler, David Herr, Timothy Barzik, for more information and directions to that website if you can't find it readily. Matt, why don't you go ahead and begin with introductions to the speakers.
Thank you, Andrew. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the seminar, Estimating Risks from Petroleum Hydrocarbons Using Spreadsheets. We're lucky this morning to have with us Roger Brewer from the state of Hawaii and Hunsik Park from the state of Washington. Both of these gentlemen have done some groundbreaking work in developing spreadsheet tools for evaluating risk associated with exposure to environmental contaminants. They're going to enlighten us today about some of the key aspects of these tools that they've created and how they've incorporated cumulative risk into these tools and into the risk estimates that are derived from these spreadsheet tools. I'll just remind everyone that all of the information that we'll be discussing today, including the presentations, the spreadsheets, guidance documents, publications associated with these spreadsheets, and case studies are available for download from the CLUIN website from the page associated with this particular seminar. So I think you'll find that information informative, if not overwhelming. However, I do encourage you to look at the spreadsheets, use them, and see if they will be good tools that might work for you. So without too much further ado, let me introduce our speakers. First up, we're going to have Roger Brewer. He is a senior scientist and environmental hazard assessment specialist. He works in Hawaii with the Hawaii Department of Health, and he has a wide range of environmental experience. He's been a regulator in at least two states, Hawaii, California. He's worked on regulatory compliance audits, field investigations, contaminant patent transport, human health, ecological risk assessments. He's also done environmental consulting, and he's worked internationally on environmental issues. I know of his work in China and India, and so he has a lot in South America also. And he's a senior geologist and environmental risk assessment specialist, and he's also a PhD in geology. So we also have with us today Hunsik Park. He's a professional engineer and senior civil engineer and environmental engineer with the Toxics Cleanup Program, Washington State Department of Ecology. He provides guidance and assistance to site managers and to the public working on contaminated site investigations and cleanups, operation and maintenance activities. He conducts cost engineering, fate and transport modeling, and a variety of assessment activities. He's written state technical guidance on natural attenuation, state technical policy on assessing subsurface contaminant vapor migration, and developed supplementary state guidance on geostatistics to fit in the risk-based cleanup approach. He's also managing the cleanup of hazardous waste sites, and he studied at Utah State and has an MS in environmental engineering from the Asian Institute of Technology, which I believe is in Thailand. Is that right, Hunsik?
That is correct.
And both of these gentlemen saw a need for tools for the average regulator, consultant, and responsible party to quickly evaluate the potential impacts of contaminants and better understand the risks associated with exposure to multiple contaminants. And they tried to fill this need by creating spreadsheet tools that help you evaluate the exposure and the potential risk associated with these contaminants. So, Roger, I believe you're going to start us off with this.
Yeah, can you hear me, Matt?
I can hear you just fine. I think you're going to start us off with a little saying from Confucius.
Oh, I just put that up to kill some time. It's actually from a movie I saw a couple of weeks ago. There are three methods to gain knowledge. The first, reflection, is noblest. The second, imitation, is the easiest. And the third, experience, is the bitterest. So this fits a lot with my experience. You know, one thing Matt and I do a lot is we reflect on our experience, on our bitter experience, and try to write some guidance so that make our lives easier in the work we do and for everyone else. So the next slide, it's my slide number two. You'll see a photograph of a site in downtown Honolulu that we've been working on. It used to be an above ground tank storage farm, completely trashed with gasoline, diesel, and they're putting a new Lowe's store there. I'll be using this as an example if we have time toward the end. We'll talk about our guidance we put together for investigating, evaluating, and remediating petroleum contaminated sites with a focus on TPH and petroleum. There are a few things I want to go over today. First, I want to go over an overview of what we call environmental hazard evaluation. We've sort of gotten away from the term risk assessment for the broad scale type of work we do. Keep risk assessment a little more confined to toxicology. Then I'm going to talk about our environmental screening levels, how we develop those. We have lots of spreadsheet models and such. And then we have what we call an environmental screening level surfer, some electronic lookup tables, where we can screen a site now once we have the data. In the past, when Matt and I were doing this 15 years ago, it would take about a year, year and a half to do a risk assessment. And we can screen data now and know within a few minutes if we have a potential problem at a site with our electronic lookup tables. And then I'm going to focus on petroleum and especially TPH. And how do you look at TPH in a cumulative risk assessment? And that's one of the biggest problems I think a lot of us have seen, especially if we do field work too, is the TPH fraction of petroleum tends to be ignored in risk assessments. And that's why it's so common we'll be at a site that's heavily contaminated, say with something like diesel fuel, and someone does a risk assessment and it comes back and says the site's fine. And you're at the site and you realize this something isn't quite right. So we'll talk about how you look at TPH from a risk assessment standpoint, and then talk about, for petroleum contamination in general, what really drives the need for cleanup at a site. Is it really traditional risk, or is it something else? Next slide, slide number three, the references. The first document, evaluation of environmental hazards at sites with contaminated soil and groundwater. That's sort of our Bible we use for our risk assessment, if you want to call it that. Edition I put up here is actually our Pacific Basin edition that we use outside of Hawaii and Guam, Saipan, and the South Pacific and other areas. There's another edition in Hawaii, and there's one also did for California. The reason I like the Pacific Basin edition is it more closely follows US EPA guidance. It doesn't have, you know, California's toxicity factors or Hawaii's surface water standards and such. And the second document I'm not going to talk about too much is our technical guidance manual on how to actually do the field work. So the next slide, slide number four, and here's an overview of what, again, we refer to as environmental hazard evaluation. And I split environmental work that we do into three stages. First is you go out and find out what you have. It's a site investigation. You're out collecting samples and such. Then under environmental hazard evaluation, you're looking at your data and determining if you have any potential environmental hazards or risk posed by the contamination at the site. And then after that, then you have some kind of response action. You either clean it up, no further action or whatever. Okay. As you flag different environmental hazards, then you could do an advanced evaluation of specific targeted hazards like direct exposure, vapor intrusion, leaching as necessary on a site-by-site basis. This usually isn't really necessary. A lot of smaller petroleum sites, they don't have the time and money to do this. They just go in, clean it up without a lot of additional evaluation. Let's look at this environmental hazard evaluation step. And again, that's what a lot of people might refer to as risk assessment. So in slide number five, you've probably seen this conceptual site model. I've plagiarized it from some US EPA presentations and guidance, I think. But this just shows the range of potential environmental hazards that you could have at petroleum contaminated sites. if you just look at contaminated soil, there's five potential environmental hazards. The one a lot of the toxicologists initially think of is direct exposure. See the kid playing in the black muck there. It's a traditional direct exposure to contaminated soil. Yeah, for humans, we call it direct exposure. For bugs and bunnies, we call it ecotoxicity. So there's another potential environmental hazard. Contaminants could also leach out of the soil and contaminate groundwater, so we have a leaching environmental hazard. If it's a volatile contaminant, if you look over to the right under the house, a little pot of contaminated soil under the house, you could have vapors coming into the house. The vapor intrusion is the fourth potential environmental hazard. And then there's one which is especially important for petroleum. It's just plain old gross contamination, which we'll look at more later on. So it may not be toxic, but it could actually be explosive in some cases for petroleum. It may just smell bad or cause nuisances or sheens and such. So those are the five environmental hazards for contaminated soil. For contaminated groundwater, there's four most common environmental hazards that we look at every site initially to screen it with. If it's a source of drinking water, then obviously impacts the drinking water resources is a primary environmental hazard. If it's a volatile contaminant, you could have vapors coming out of the groundwater and, again, intruding into building. So vapor intrusion. You could also have discharge of contaminated groundwater into aquatic habitats in the streams and shorelines. This is a big deal, especially in coastal areas like Hawaii and in California and other places where I've worked. Or again, the fourth environmental hazard, contaminated groundwater, just could be gross contamination, free product. And this could be a problem just from general vapor production, methane production, but also free product seeping out into streams or into storm lines and creating sheens on aquatic habitats. Or even just from a construction standpoint, when you're digging into heavily, grossly contaminated soil, it causes a lot of problems. So that's an overview of our environmental hazards that we look at every site. And we could have additional ones with this. These are the primary ones. If you look at the next slide, the next thing we do once we have all these environmental hazards is we actually compile screening levels for each one of these different environmental hazards for soil and groundwater. This is slide number 5. Then this is an example for benzene screening levels, assuming a residential site use, and we'll say the groundwater is the source of drinking water.
I'm sorry.
You see all the numbers in here.
Page 6, Roger.
Slide 6? Okay, sorry, slide 6. Okay. So you see all the numbers in there that these are mostly just compiled from existing other guidance. If you see the soil direct exposure screening level here for benzene is 1.1 milligrams per kilogram, that's the US EPA regional screening level, residential. And we have screening levels in there for vapor intrusion to indoor air, either from groundwater for soil, that's using the US EPA's vapor intrusion model. It's more calibrated to, say, Hawaii conditions. If you look down at the groundwater standards, you see the drinking water screening levels. The drinking water screening level, 5 micrograms per liter, that's the drinking water standard for benzene, primary drinking water standard. Over on the left-hand side, for ecological concerns, for groundwater, again, see aquatic habitats, 46 micrograms per liter, that's the our chronic surface water standard for benzene and surface water. So we use that to screen groundwater. For terrestrial habitats, you'll see 25 milligrams per kilogram. That's actually a published, I think it's phytotoxicity-based screening level for benzene in the soil. And then you see the two gross contamination screening levels, one for soil, one for drinking water, groundwater. And for soil, 500 milligrams per kilogram, that's when you can start to smell benzene in soil. Nothing else is a nuisance issue. Gross contamination in groundwater, drinking water, 170 micrograms per liter. That's a secondary MCL or secondary taste and odor concerns, drinking water screening level. And then you see a leaching-based screening level for soil, 0.31 milligrams per kilogram. And that's based on a model put together initially by Oregon and Massachusetts and Ontario, several other states and provinces are using this model. So these are all the screening levels we use for each contaminant. If you look at it, for groundwater, drinking water screening level 5 micrograms per liter is lower than anyone else in the other screening level. So we say drinking water toxicity means drive risk for benzene in groundwater. It's a source of drinking water. And for leaching in soil, for soil, the 0.31 milligrams per kilogram, it's a leaching-based action level. It's lower than any of the other screening levels, So we say leaching drives into environmental hazards. So anyway, that's how we do environmental hazard evaluation here. We compile screening levels for all the environmental hazards.
Roger, this is Matt. I just wanted to mention that to the folks online that the screen you're looking at on slide number 6 is what you see in Roger's spreadsheet. That's the user interface where you actually see these calculations presented in this same graphical format. I also want to mention that folks on the line, please put your phone on mute if you can, or if you don't have a mute button, you can press star six to mute, #6 to unmute, because I can hear folks coughing and some other people talking in the background. So please put on mute. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so if you look at the next slide, slide number 7, these are our environmental screening levels. We have these types of screening levels for about 150 different contaminants now. We have screening levels for soil, groundwater, surface water, soil gas, indoor air. And we assume there's no significant environmental hazard if the concentration of contaminant is less than our screening levels. You see volume 1, volume 2 just summarize where our screening levels came from and in general how they're used, our guidance. The next slide, slide 8, the use of our screening levels. You know, one of the biggest uses of the screening levels is just to screen out low-risk sites so that the property owners and such don't have to deal with the regulators. And it helps us weed out sites we really need to look at. Again, real quickly, identify potential environmental hazards at a site. And real quickly, you know, you don't want to find out 10 years later that you have vapor intrusion problems at a site, which I've seen happen at a few of the projects I've worked on. With some public screening levels, you can identify that immediately and look at it in more detail. And then the next slide, slide number 9, this is where it gets really useful. A guy, Laurent Millier, and California EPA came up with this a couple of years ago. It's our ESL Surfer, slide number 9, just an overview. These are electronic lookup tables. You can download these from our webpage, the reference I gave up front. And just real quickly now, you can screen your site data and it'll immediately flag potential specific environmental hazards at the site. There's printable report summaries you can print out also, including reports. Some other electronic tools we have a Tier 2 direct exposure model. Just for screening levels, it's pretty much US EPA RSLs, but you can adjust toxicity factors, exposure factors, thicknesses, contaminated soil and such, and it'll adjust your screening levels. There's also a batch test leaching model we have looking at leaching. If your site gets flagged potential leaching hazards, you can run a laboratory leaching test on it. Then we have a vapor intrusion model. It's just US EPA's model. If you look at the next slide, this is just a front picture of our ESL Surfer, slide number 10. See step 1, step 2, step 3 over on the left. We made it really simple. In step 1, you just pick your land use, but it's unrestricted, which means residential, schools, medical care, whatever, or versus a commercial industrial use only. The second box, you would click on groundwater utility, and you can choose between drinking water resource and not a drinking water resource. And then also, depth of impact of soil, is it exposed at the surface or is it shallow or deep? And for this case, we assume deep soils are greater than 10 feet, 3 meters, shallow soils are anything less than 3 meters deep. This real quickly allows you to set up your site scenario. And you'll see the screen levels change potentially anyway as you're doing this based on land use, groundwater utility, and depth of contaminated soil. Step 2, you can select from 150 different contaminants. I think we have most of them covered now. And real quickly, once you select a different contaminant, it'll immediately show you what the screening levels are for that contaminant. And in step 3, you can actually input site data for your site, representative soil, groundwater, or soil gas concentrations. And you see the X's over on the right. It'll pop up and just note whether or not the concentrations of contaminant you have at your site exceed these screening levels for soil, groundwater, soil gas. And the final tier 1 ESL, as you see on the right in the blue box, these are the lowest screening levels. Out of all those screening levels, say for benzene in soil, this just picks the lowest one, and we call that our tier 1 screening level. That's the only number you see initially. I don't have the next slides in here, but there's several additional worksheets. This is all in Excel. So in the first page, it just flags yes or no, do I have a problem with my soil? I have benzene in contaminated soil. You go to the next worksheet, and it'll tell you specifically which environmental hazards are a potential problem at that site. for your soil and for your groundwater. And there's some other notes you go with it. This is a pretty fun tool. So you can download it again off our website and see how it works. That's how we set up our environmental hazard evaluation. We have environmental screening levels for 150 different contaminants that are based on either published screening levels or different models of vapor intrusion, direct exposure, whatever. And if you look at the next slide, slide number 11, and the next thing we have to look at is how do we incorporate TPH into this whole environmental hazard evaluation or risk assessment scenario. And again, this has been the critical problem we've seen at a lot of sites. I can show you one slide that the site that caught on fire I was working on that passed a risk assessment. So next slide, petroleum contaminants, potential concern for gasolines. If you look at this, and most we always screen for BTECs, MTBE. These are targeted and specific for individual VOCs or contaminants for gasoline contaminated soil. And most gasolines contain about less than 15% BTECs and MTBE and such. PAHs, maybe less than 1% PAHs. It's going to be mostly naphthalenes. So there's 85% of the material for the compounds then get lumped together as TPH. Most risk assessments traditionally just focus on BTECs, maybe naphthalene, and they ignore the other 85% of the contaminants there, which isn't a good idea. If you look at the next slide, petroleum contaminants and potential concern, these are for middle distillates. You have BTECs, it's usually less than 1% of your composition of diesel fuel, say. PAH is methyl naphthalene, naphthalene is 2 to 3%. This is slide number 12. So 97% of the compounds in diesel fuel, they aren't BTECs or PAHs. So, it's no big surprise when you run a risk assessment, a traditional human health risk assessment on diesel contaminated soil that it almost always passes because all they're looking at is BTECs and there's nothing in there. So you're ignoring 97% of the compounds. So we had to come up with a way to look at TPH separately and treat it as you would any individual contaminant. So if you look at the next slide, slide 13, what we start off with, and this is straight from Massachusetts DEP's BPH EPH guidance, anyone from Massachusetts on the line. And this is also a group, TPH working group did this back in the early 90s. They looked at petroleum and in this case split it up into six different carbon ranges. I think the TPH working group looked at 12 different carbon ranges. Same idea though, you have aliphatic compounds, aromatic compounds, and they summarize fate and transport and toxicity factors for each one of these different carbon range fractions. You see here sorption coefficient, Henry's constant, reference doses, inhalation, reference concentrations. These are all the factors that you need to come up with screening levels or to incorporate these carbon range fractions into a standard biological assessment. So that's what we did. So we start off with this, and if you look at slide 14, then we look at gasoline and say, okay, for gasoline, what are we going to assume gasoline is made of? And in Massachusetts guidance, and with the guys that we put together too, we assume that gasoline is composed of 100% C11 through C22 aromatics, just from a risk assessment standpoint. And this is the TPH fraction after you take out the BTECs and the lighter range ends. So now we can use all the toxicity factors and fate and transport factors for C11, C22 aromatics and develop our own and develop screening levels for TPH gasoline, or we can incorporate TPH gasoline into a traditional human health risk assessment. And again, especially when you're looking at cumulative risk, it's important to look at this, obviously look at 85% of the compounds in the mixture you're looking at. You need to include that in cumulative risk. That's what we do for gasoline. The next slide, about diesel fuel or middle distillates, this is slide 15. Here's how Massachusetts, and we looked at it and agreed, you break up, say, typical diesel fuel, assume that it's 60% C11 to C22 aromatics, so we have all the toxicity factors and fate transport factors for those, 40% C9 to C18 aliphatics compounds. And then for TPH middle distillates for diesel fuel, we develop action levels or screening levels based on weighted toxicity factors and fate and transport constants for this mixture of C9, of aliphatic and aromatic compounds in these two carbon ranges. So it's pretty simple once you do this. If you look at the next slide, Slide 16, here's just a summary of the sorption coefficients, Henry's constants, reference doses, inhalation reference concentrations that we use for TPH gasoline, TPH middle distillates, TPH RF is TPH residual fuels. So now we can treat this TPH just like we would benzene, or ethylbenzene, or naphthalene, whatever. It's just another compound with another set of toxicity factors and fate and transport constants. And incorporate that in the site-specific risk assessments for environmental hazard evaluations, as we call them, and come up with screening levels. Let's look at some of these screening levels. And then you're going to see it mixed in here. Next slide, 17, TPH soil action levels. In Hawaii, we call them action levels. In California, we call them screening levels. It's all the same thing. I just had it mixed up in the slides. So here's our soil screening levels or action levels for TPH. So for direct exposure concerns, TPH gasoline, again using, assuming C11 to C22 carbon range fraction and the toxicity factors and such, we come up with a direct exposure screening level of 600 milligrams per kilogram. And it's based on, in this case, the target hazard quotient of 0.5. For diesel fuel, and this is where it gets critical, the direct exposure screening level, here you see is 500 milligrams per kilogram. That's actually the saturation level for TPH diesel fuel in soil. So just like they do in the traditional human health risk assessment, for a volatile contaminant, once you get above the saturation level, the model can no longer predict vapor phase concentrations of the contaminant in soil gas or vapor emissions out to air, so you set your screening level to the saturation level. This CSAT is real critical, concentration saturation. If you ignore that in screening levels, that's where you come up with screening levels, cleanup levels of 50,000 milligrams per kilogram for diesel fuel, because they were ignoring the saturation limitations. So once you get above CSAT again, you have free product in the soil, and the model traditionally used in human health risk assessments is based on vapor emissions from dissolve phase, not from free product. So that model is no longer valid. You have to set your screening levels or cutoffs at saturation. For vapor intrusion, we use soil gas. We'll look at that in a minute. We don't have any soil screening levels for TPH, gasoline, or diesel fuel for vapor intrusion. You still get soil gas data. And leaching action levels around 100 ppm for diesel fuel and gasoline. You can see that's lower than direct exposure. So you see right away, if you clean up a site just to address direct exposure concerns, you could have potential leaching concerns. Gross contamination, just when is gasoline, diesel fuel, contaminated soil start to smell really bad, if nothing else, you don't want it in your backyard. It's still, again, lower than direct exposure concerns for gasoline, about 100 ppm. TPH middle distillates, about 500 ppm. Same thing. Let's look at the next slide, slide 18. So here's this site where I got enlightened. It was when I was still a consultant working at a site that it's a gasoline station site. You see some fire in a backhoe here. The site had been closed for 20 years. The tanks have been taken out, I think, or at least 10 years. They excavated out all the soil they could get. It was about 20, 30 feet to groundwater. And I was actually looking at the risk assessment for this. And again, back then, we were just looking at benzene, VTEX, and the site looked fine. We didn't have any soil gas data. We were just looking at soil and groundwater data. They went in to put an underground parking garage at the site, started digging through the soil, and you could smell the gasoline vapors there. And as you're digging through the soil, it would actually catch on fire. The vapors were so hot. And this wasn't methane, maybe some methane. It was mostly just TPH gasoline vapors in the soil gas. This is a good example. We always collect soil gas samples at these sites. But if you looked at this site, even if you looked at soil gas samples and the soil data, if you just looked at benzene, you would totally miss this potential issue at a site. So if nothing else, you don't consider a site catching on fire as a risk. If nothing else, we call it a gross contamination hazard. Again, we do this differently now than obviously we would have back then. So gross contamination hazards tend to drive cleanup of petroleum contaminated sites, especially for gasoline, not direct exposure. If you look at the next slide, here's our TPH screening levels for groundwater. So you see target hazards, slide 19, have direct drinking water toxicity, about 100 micrograms per liter you can start, but when according to the toxicity factors we use for gasoline, middle distillates, somewhere around in there is when it becomes its toxicity point. Taste and odor concerns, that's the nice thing with petroleum, you usually can smell it before it becomes too big of a problem. But about the same, we use 100 micrograms per liter just for taste and odor hazards for TPH in drinking water. again, vapor intrusion. When do you need to worry about vapors coming out of gasoline contaminated groundwater? I wouldn't trust the models. In most cases, you really do need to start having free product there before you have major vapor concerns that we've seen, but you're better off going out and collecting soil gas. You always want to look for methane, too. Impacts, discharge of petroleum contaminated groundwater into surface water. These numbers you see here for aquatic impacts are based on a study done in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's 500 micrograms per liter for gasoline, 640 for diesel fuel, and TPH. So this is the level of TPH gasoline and diesel fuel that could pose potential aquatic toxicity hazards. So again, that's another big problem is with the store, groundwater is not a source of drinking water, so who cares? Well, obviously if you go out to a site and you see contaminated groundwater discharging into aquatic habitat, that's a problem you need to look at. These are all, again, just to screen the data initially. Then as needed, you go and look at it in more detail. Again, for next slide, 20, drinking, for TPH in groundwater, source of drinking water, you still have to look at gross contamination or secondary MCLs. They tend to drive environmental hazards for TPH in drinking water, just like they do for soil, even though they're fairly close to toxicity-based hazards. And then next slide, slide 21, is TPH indoor air and soil gas screening levels. So again, we set toxicity factors for TPH, gasoline, and diesel fuel. That means we can set an indoor air screening level. And then if we know what our indoor air screening level is, based on where you are, you can multiply that by an assumed dilution factor and come up with a soil gas screening level. And in Hawaii, in sort of moderate temperate climates, the data I've seen, looking at vapor intrusion studies, you know, we use a dilution factor of around 1,000 for residential, 2,000 for commercial buildings. So you take your indoor air screening level, multiply by 1,000, and there's your soil gas screening level for vapors immediately under the slab of a building or in shallow soil gas. So you see our soil gas screening level for TPH gasoline is 26 micrograms per cubic meter. And it's once you start going out testing soil gas for TPH gasoline, then a lot of sites we're seeing get flagged for potential vapor intrusion concerns where you may not have any other obvious concern at a site. If you look at the next slide, slide 22, if you're not familiar with vapor intrusion hazards, I guess most people are at this point. Here's just an example of our TPH gasoline action levels for vapor intrusion. The groundwater and soil, again, we don't have any screening levels, action levels, same thing. We just have a soil gas screening level for TPH gasoline immediately under the slab of a building. And so if you exceed that, then ideally you would, next step would be go and test indoor air. We rarely recommend that people test indoor air for petroleum-related compounds. If you get flagged with a potential problem from your soil gas, you need to start doing some cleanup or some kind of mitigation to reduce vapor intrusion into the building. The problem is the background TPH in most buildings is around 100 plus micrograms per cubic meter. It could be 1,000 micrograms per cubic meter just from cleaning fluids. Somebody has a can of gasoline in their closet or something or in the garage. Auto exhaust, 100 to 1,000 micrograms per cubic meter TPH. So it's really hard to test indoor air and pinpoint where that TPH is coming from. And that slide 23, here's just some example soil gas data. And again, just like for soil, this slide is meant just to emphasize what you're missing if you're just looking at VTEX and soil gas. And a lot of soil gas surveys, if you just look at VTEX, you're going to miss potential vapor intrusion hazards. I've even seen some sites where the buildings, and they smell like diesel fuel. There's so much vapor coming up through the floor drains. But if you tested the benzene in the air, it's not going to be obvious you have a problem. Just some example sites here, Honolulu Harbor, it's a typical harbor, lots of gas or oil pipelines and such going around. They've been doing a lot of soil gas work there. You know, TPH, just the TPH or non-VTEX and, say, naphthalene fraction of the soil vapors makes up 99.97% of the soil gas. That's TPH. So benzene is less than 0.1%, and there's really nothing else there. So vapor intrusion hazards there are purely driven by TPH, not benzene. Pearl Harbor, another harbor, mixture of gas and diesel. Again, we're seeing the same thing at all these sites, 99.41% TPH. That's in the vapor, soil gas, and just trace amounts of benzene, VTEX, a little bit more naphthalene, it's probably coming from the diesel fuel. Here's a typical gas station next, Aloha Station. Same thing, it's almost all TPH. a little bit of more benzene, though, since it's ghastly, not too unexpected. There's actually enough benzene in the soil gas to pose potential vapor intrusion problems at this site also. Then the last site, Gasco, it's a manufactured gas plant. They used to make benzene there. So here there's still enough TPH in the soil gas to pose vapor intrusions just based on TPH alone, but then the benzene levels in the soil vapors are outrageous. It's almost 80% benzene in some of the soil gas samples. So that's a major problem. This is what, that point here is that TPH tends to drive environmental hazards or risk at most sites we look at for soil, even groundwater and for soil gas, and in some cases benzene may also. That's all I had, and it's, I have a few example sites attached here that maybe after Hunsie gives his presentation we can go over some examples. We have what we call environmental hazard maps put together where we actually go out and make a map of a site and show where the specific environmental hazards are. Matt, after that, hopefully you can still hear me.
And, no, Roger, you're just talking to yourself.
Turn
there.
It over.
You're talking to yourself.
That's happened before. I'm on Skype, but if anybody ever wants to use Skype, sometimes I get cut off. And, Matt, I'll go ahead and pass it over to Hunsie.
Okay, that worked out well. Skype was clear, and that was a good presentation. Thanks for sharing the information on your tool and on TPH in general.
Matt.
Yes.
This is Dave Herr. We have one, actually there's two online questions now, if we want to try to address them. The first is from Tony Windsor of Dillon Consulting, and he was wondering if the surfer screening tool is customizable, for example, changing the screening standards for another jurisdiction.
It is, and that's, I'll give you that we worked on this about 10 years, but the surfer, but there's a master spreadsheet and tool that we have that, if anybody wants it, just send me an email and I'll get it to you. It's about 70 worksheets. It's attached to vapor intrusion models and direct exposure models and all this other, and it's all fed into it. So we use it to update it, say like the naphthalene toxicity factor changes. It's set up now, I just go and change the cancer slope factor for naphthalene and all the other screening levels automatically get updated. So if you're interested in a copy of that, then just send an email to me. I'd be glad to help you set it up.
I'll mention that you do need to have a little bit of advanced Excel knowledge, because this is a spreadsheet that has quite a bit of advanced macros and programming in it. But if you do know Excel fairly well, you can go in and adapt it to your own needs pretty quickly.
Okay, there's two other questions here. The first one is on slide 23. Are those percentages of total volatiles or of the soil gas? In other words, was the sample...
It's the soil gas. So if you just look at total volatiles in the soil gas.
Okay. And the last one is on slide 14. What is the basis of assuming gasoline range TPH to be 100% C11 to C22 aromatics? It seems more reasonable to assume C9 to C10 aromatics in gasoline. Also, what is the odor threshold for TPH vapor? This is from CY Yang and California ETSC.
Okay. Yeah, and that's an interesting point. I think it was purely a toxicity call from Massachusetts DEP. If you look at their 2002-2003 guidance that we have reference for VPH, EPH, that's the, essentially, the toxicity factors and such they chose as default for gasoline. I want to mention, too, that these toxicity factors for the air, the different carbon range fractions, DTSC in California is looking at these in more detail. I know some people are skeptical, they may be excessively conservative. So that would definitely, it'd be nice for someone else to look at that in more detail.
There's a number of groups that have looked at toxicity of these various hydrocarbon ranges. And part of the problem is that, there's a number of compounds within these ranges, so you have to use a surrogate compound. And sometimes, correct me if I'm wrong here, Hunsik or Roger, but I think they're often trying to be conservative in using the more toxic of the compounds within a hydrocarbon range. And the other problem that we have is there's, potentially hundreds of chemicals you're dealing with here, and most of these don't really have toxicity values. So sometimes you're limited by the available values within that hydrocarbon range based on which chemicals have actually been evaluated.
Yeah, so you look for it. You look at that entire, what you're lumping together is TPH or carbon range fraction and making a best professional judgment call on what the toxicity of that fraction is. And also see why I ask about odor thresholds for diesel fuel and for TPH and probably in indoor air. You know, for gasoline, it's around 100 micrograms per cubic meter, and for diesel fuel, maybe around 1,000, if you look at some ATSDR's published information. So we're not that far away from odor thresholds being reached really at the time you start hitting potential toxicity concerns. And we do allow people to look at toxicity factors on a side-by-side basis for TPH.
Okay, one last question had come in is, can you, this person would like you to send him the surfer. Could you just state the web address where he can download the surfer again, please?
Yeah, if you go back and look at the third slide for references, and then the reference, the web page URL is included there. Just make sure you get the Pacific Basin edition. And again, the surfer you get off the web page is just, it's not going to have a lot of the models and factors in it that you can change and modify site by site. We've taken that out just to make it simpler to use. So if you want to be able to take the surfer and modify it on your own, you need to contact me directly, and I'll try to get that posted to our FTP site, maybe a zip file or something. And you have to know a little bit about Excel. I've never read an Excel manual. You have to read the instructions. You know, they screwed up on how to design. But I can work with you on that.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we're moving on, correct, Dave?
Yeah.
No more questions, Dave?
Well, I think we better give Hunsik a chance.
Yeah, that wraps up the online questions.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and get a presentation here from Hunsik Park of Washington State Department of Ecology. And following Hunsik's presentation, we will probably still have about a half an hour for questions, both online and over the phone. So Hunsik, please take it away. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. I'm Hunsik. Hunsik Park with the Washington State Department of Ecology, Olympia, Washington. Can you hear me all right, Matt?
I hear you very well, and I just want to add that Hunsik's presentation begins on slide number 32.
32, right, slide number 32. All right. Just a minute ago, Roger of Hawaii focused on the use of equivalent carbon range toxicity information and the fade and transport constants to develop generic soil and groundwater cleanup level of TPH. He also mentioned that there exists an alternative to collect site-specific carbon range data rather than a single TPH data. This morning, I'm going to discuss more on how the Washington State is setting up site-specific risk-based cleanup goal at the site contaminated with a petroleum hydrocarbon wheat fractionated approaches. Next slide, please. Slide 33. The topics for this morning will be a brief discussion on general problems associated with a petroleum contaminated site and how the Washington State established the cleanup level and what the risk goals are for the protection of human health and what exposure pathways have to be protected. And also, I will discuss about the fractionation of the TPH, what the fractionation of a TPH is. Along with these type of topics, I will discuss about the accumulated risk assessment matches what we have been chosen for petroleum components. For the cross-media concern, we need to discuss about how multiple chemicals interact each other and with the nature of the medium during the transport process. At last, I will briefly introduce Washington State spreadsheet tool to estimate cumulative risk from TPH contamination and how to set up petroleum cleanup level along with the summary outcomes of the calculation result. Next slide, please. Slide 34. Petroleum products are one of the major contaminants in hazardous waste sites. In fact, over 70% of the contaminated sites are somewhat related with the petroleum contamination. Petroleum is a very complex mixture of chemicals. It consists almost over 100 to 10,000 constituents. Because of that, petroleum exhibits large range of behaviors in environment and wide range of the toxicity. Chemicals with different chemical properties interact among themselves and with the nature of mediums. Despite of all these difficulties of risk assessments, Washington State believed that it was necessary to quantify the risk from petroleum contaminated sites so that we can protect human health and environment with a scientifically defensible and consistent manner. Next slide, please. Slide 35. Let's see how we establish the cleanup level. I'm pretty sure these projects are very similar to all other state and federal level of the cleanup business. First, we establish the beneficial use of land, groundwaters, and adjacent surface water, if any. Then we design the conceptual site model from the contamination sources to the exposure pathway connecting to the receptors, such as human as well as the environment. And then we determine the applicability of the cleanup goals. For instance, exposure parameters and the cancer risk goals are different depending upon how the site is designated either as an industrial or residential area. After conducting extensive field remedial investigation, we identify indicated hazardous substance or chemical of concern. Then we establish cleanup level considering all aspects, including cross-media transfer, such as the surface water to groundwater to soil media. If there are any concern on analytical sensitivity, backgrounds, other applicable federal state law, we allow adjust cleanup level upward. After conducting remediation work, the liable parties are supposed to demonstrate the compliance with all cleanup standards determined during the cleanup action planning stage. Next slide, slide 36. Under Washington State Cleanup Regulation, or we call MGCA rules, there are three methods to establish cleanup level. Method A is intended to provide conservative cleanup level for sites undergoing routine cleanup actions and for a site with a relatively very few hazardous substances. It composed of a lookup table for 26 chemicals, groundwater, and soil cleanup level. Method B and C are site-specific and risk-based cleanup levels based on policy defined and the different exposure parameters and target risk. Method C can be used under limited conditions and normally based on adult exposures with the individual chemicals cancer risk of 1 in 100,000. And then method B is for universal method based on young child exposure with individual chemicals cancer risk of 1 in 1 million. This morning, I'm going to discuss about method B cleanup levels for petroleum hydrocarbons. Next slide. Slide 37, please. Total petroleum hydrocarbon, or TPH, is defined as the measurable amount of a petroleum-based hydrocarbon in an environmental media, and this is dependent on analysis of medium in which it is found. While providing an overall concentration of the petroleum hydrocarbon, TPH itself is not a direct indicator of the risk posed by petroleum hydrocarbon contamination. Let's take a look at the various TPH assessment methods. There are three basic approaches that have been used in the past to estimate potential human health risk posed by TPH contamination. The one most generally applied for the evaluation of risk from TPH is an indicator approach. This approach assumes that the estimated risk from TPH is characterized by a small number of indicator compounds such as BTEX, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, or carcinogenic pHs, and etc. Another approach is the whole product, the surrogate approach, assume that TPH can be characterized by a single or a few representative surrogate compounds. This approach could overestimate or underestimate toxicity and mobility because of the compound typically available for use as a surrogate. For example, if you use benzene as a surrogate compound for the aromatic, then you will overestimate risk because benzene might be faster and more toxic than most of other petroleum compounds. Both indicators and the whole product approaches are not capable of taking into account effects of weathering, such as the changes in composition of components, toxicity, mobility over the time at different medium, and the wide range of toxicity property of widely different petroleum products. The recently developed fractionated approach is compromised between these two conventional methods. The risk as a result of petroleum contamination can be estimated for each of the fractions as individual contaminants by assuming additivities of risk. Next slide, slide 38. Now, Washington State has its own analytical protocol for petroleum sample fractionated data. We call it BPH and EPH. BPH is for gasoline, EPH for middle and heavier distillated. There is a slight overlap in between these two analyses. BPH analytical method is based on modified EPA methods, 80 and 20, I believe, and 80, 15. We have a total of 7 aliphatic and 5 aromatic fractions with a similar state and transfer properties and toxicity for use in risk assessment. The lighter hydrocarbon fractions are analyzed by purge and trap GC analysis using a flame ionization detector, FID, to measure the total hydrocarbons and then a PID or polar ionization detectors to measure the aromatic with the aliphatic components of TPH being found by the dippers. The heavier hydrocarbons are analyzed using methylene chloride extraction procedure followed by a column separation using a silica gel of the aromatic and the aliphatic fraction. These two fractions are then analyzed using GCFID. Next slide, please. Slide 39. Using the predetermined toxicological property of each carbon fraction or equivalent carbons, we established the groundwater cleanup level based on exposure pathways such as human health protection or other site-specific pathway. For soil, we established human health protected cleanup level through the concurrent exposures due to the ingestion and thermal exposures. Another important aspect of the soil cleanup level is the cross-media transfer, such as the leaching potential for the protection of the groundwater. As such, we need to convert the soil concentration into the groundwater concentration using the transfer model and predetermined chemical properties. Also, pastoral ecological evaluation and pathways such as the vapor intrusion are needed depending upon site-specific situation. Final cleanup level will be governed by the exposure pathway that will produce the most restrictive or lowest level. In the next 10 slides, we are going to discuss about the base formula to set up TPH cleanup levels for human health protection and to estimate the leaching potential for soil media. Next slide, please. Slide 40. As far as the direct ingestion or human health protection pathway for soil and groundwater media is concerned, we assume that adverse effect or cancer risk resulting from exposure to two or more hazardous substances with a similar type of toxic responses, such as the TPH, are assumed to be additive unless scientific evidence is available to demonstrate otherwise. While this is purely a policy choice. And also as a policy choice, we define that TPH cleanup level is a function of the weight composition of the product and should represent a weighted average toxicity of all of the components in a given product. The base formula to set up the TPH cleanup level is shown right over here on the screen. TPH cleanup level is calculated by assuming that the risk for the individual fraction can be added each weighted by their composition in the total petroleum mixtures. If you look at the formula over here, cleanup level for component I for one carbon fraction is for cleanup level for each carbon fraction. Once the petroleum composition has been fully characterized at the site, additional sampling can rely on traditional and less expensive TPH analysis rather than fractionated analysis. Next slide, slide 41. Well, and then how about leaching potential from soil to groundwaters? Not knowing much of the behaviors of TPH in the environment in the past, we simply applied 100 times of groundwater cleanup levels. For instance, in order to meet 1,000 microgram per liter of groundwater cleanup level, we simply multiply by 100, then results becomes 100 milligram per kilogram of soil cleanup level for gasoline products. For diesel, we know that the solubility of diesel is much lower than gasoline. We just added a safety factor of 2, then 200 milligram per kilogram had been the cleanup level for diesel contaminated soil for a long period of time. Under the new regulation, we started to allow various methods that include four-phase partitioning equilibrium modeling, which is the default method, or some experimental teaching test, or empirical demonstration and other method. The default four-phase model considers properties of absorption, volatilization, vapor saturation, and the solubility limit. In addition to that, the model incorporates the aspect of mass and volume conservation and dilution with a clean infiltrated groundwater. Since four-phase model is considered as a default method to evaluate the petroleum contaminated soil, we'll take a close look. In the next slide, we'll discuss about assumptions underlying this model. Next slide, please. Slide 42. In order to assess the soil cleanup level to be protected groundwater, we made reasonably conservative assumptions about factors controlling transport of hydrocarbon from soil to groundwater. Two important transport mechanisms are equilibrium partitioning and dilution. Using four-phase equilibrium partitioning view in soil, we calculate the soil leachate concentration, then simply divide it by the dilution factor to estimate ultimate groundwater concentration at the well. In this presentation, I used the default dilution factor of 20 for all calculation. I'm going to spend a little bit more time on explaining this equilibrium partitioning phenomena and its simulated results. Biological and chemical degradation was not assumed. Source of soil contamination is also conservatively assumed to be infinite. Then let's take a closer look at the soil particle of the petroleum contaminated unsaturated joint soil under the microscope to see how the chemical behave in that environment. Next slide, please. Slide 43. We'll see some soil grains, soil pore, water attached to the soil grain, and soil pore empty vapor space. And when petroleum pre-products flows into this small volume of a soil system, some will dissolve into the water phase and will evaporate to vapor space and result to soil grain. When we add more and more pre-product into the system, then all three phases become saturated eventually. Then the remainder of petroleum will stay at NAPL, which is a non-aqueous phase liquid itself. When we have a single chemical, problem is pretty easy to figure out the concentration at each phase, but not easy for thousands of chemical mixtures like petroleum, who has a wide range of chemical property. Main interest here is to estimate equilibrium soil pore water concentration of each petroleum component that becomes groundwater quality eventually after certain dilution and attenuation. We defined that the relationship between pore water concentration and vapor concentration is linear using Henle's constant, and then the relationship between pore water concentration and soil solid concentration is linear using soil organic carbon contents and organic carbon partition coefficients. The relationship between pore water concentration and content of the NAPL NAPL phase is based on Raoult's law, or so-called effective solubility approaches, using mole fraction of each component. By definition, mole fraction is the number of mole of each component, I divided by total number of mole in NAPL phase. For the NAPL mixtures in contact with the pore water, the pore water phase concentration of a NAPL component is equal to the pure aqueous solubility of the components multiplied by the mole fraction of the components in the NAPL mixture. If you are more interested in the theory, I'm not going to get into the more detail, but if you are more interested in the theory, you should be able to find related reference at the very last slide. And we conducted a limited validation of the model with a lab-scale experimentation. Next slide. Slide 40. This slide shows the predicted pore water concentration as a function of the gasoline contaminated soil concentration using different types of partitioning theory. In the test, to evaluate the leaching potential from petroleum contamination, we recommend use an effective solubility approach alone, assuming that there is plenty of oil remaining and saturated in the soil system and not considers the mass and volume conservation law. However, as you see in this graph, the flat straight line in red color in the middle of the graph. Concentration is independent of the soil concentration, but only a function of the mole fraction. So this effective the more correction function of the compositions of the all composition ratio of the all of the different chemicals in the TPH. And this effective solubility approaches alone usually overestimate the risk, particularly at the low range of concentration of with the gasoline type of lighter fuel. With a four-phase model to incorporate all aspects of partitioning, including mass and volume conservation, we could draw smooth and continuous curves, as you can see in the shaded area, to represent the transient ranges. Most of the gasoline-contaminated soil cleanup levels fall within this transition range. Next slide, please. Let's take a look at the mass distribution pattern of each component in four phase. As assumed to have a soil contaminated with 100 milligram per kilogram of TPH of typical composition ratio of fresh gasoline. Typically, the weight fraction of benzene in fresh gasoline is 3 to 5% by weight. When this fresh gasoline flows into the soil system, almost 16% of all dissolved chemicals in poor water will be composed of a benzene. When you add up TEX with benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene in poor water portion, it comes up to around 75% of the dissolved portion. The majority of the dissolved TPH is comprised of composed of the VTX, assuming MTD is not there. Of course, this mass distribution pattern changes along with the different fuel composition and types and total soil TPH concentrations. Next slide, slide number 46. Let's take a look at the predicted groundwater concentration for individual components, considering dilution factor of 20 as a function of the gasoline contaminated soil concentration. One thing very interesting we found was that the groundwater concentration of a relatively heavier fraction, heavy and in its own, tend to increase until it results in the formation of the NAFL, and then gradually decreased afterwards. So that's kind of a very interesting thing, because they, all of the components, they compete each other for the same slot. As you can see here, the transition occurs at around 92 milligram per kilogram of soil TPH for fresh gasoline. NAFL phase starts to form at around this range of the TPH concentration. Slide 47, next slide please. How about predicted groundwater TPH concentration with other type of fuel product? For heavier oil, the predicted groundwater concentration was well below 1,000 microgram per liter for most of the circumstances. Weathering process doesn't seem to diminish leaching potential very much. However, for gasoline, the groundwater TPH concentration is already over 1,000 microgram per liter at the range around 100 milligram per kilogram of soil TPH. Next slide, please. Slide 48. All these types of calculations can be made easily by the spreadsheet workbook for petroleum contaminated soil cleanup level for the protection of the ingestion and groundwater. As you see here, top portion shown in the screen is the input worksheet. What you do here is to enter the concentration each carbon fraction measured from the field data, then enter the site-specific hydrogeological conditions such as organic fractions and dilution factors and etc. And occasionally, you may want to know the soil TPH concentration that is corresponding to the target groundwater or surface water concentration instead of human health tons. Then you can enter the target groundwater concentration here. Bottom portion of the slide shows the summary of a calculation result. Cleanup level will be different depending upon what risk level goals are and exposure pathway applicable at the site. Next slide, please. Slide 49. The calculation itself is fairly easy with Excel built-in solver function. What the spreadsheet model does for us is, first, model will predict the groundwater TPH concentration with a given soil fractionated data set. And then, secondly, predicted groundwater TPH concentration will be translated into the hazard index. At last, the model will calculate backwardly to find soil TPH cleanup level that is mathematically corresponding to the hazard index of 1, which is the predicted cleanup goal. In this example, soil TPH cleanup level would be around the 70 milligrams per kilogram or so to protect the potable groundwater. Next slide, please. Slide 50. here is what we found using this type of spreadsheet TPH risk assessment tool for petroleum contaminated groundwater. The new site-specific groundwater cleanup level are the same range of the old lookup value. For soil, leaching pathway seems the more important drivers to establish the cleanup levels for gasoline or lighter fuel contaminated soil. However, ingestion pathway seems more critical pathway for heavier oil. Slide 51. In summary, petroleum hydrocarbons are a very complex mixture of thousands of compounds with a widely different chemical property and toxicity. We try to break down one single TPH information into 12 carbon fractions to evaluate wide range of the environmental behaviors of TPH in the environment. However, fate and the toxicity and transport of the degradation product of petroleum are still unknown or neglected. Policy choice is very important in order to translate the science into the policy. Among different choices, we selected additive and weighted average approaches and four-phase partition equilibrium transfer model as cumulative risk assessment tool for petroleum contamination. Washington State, the TPH approach is not perfect and not cheapest way to assess the risk of the site contaminated with the petroleum hydrocarbon, but I believe it may be one of the most scientifically valid and legally defensible site-specific risk-based and cost-effective approaches. Next slide shows the useful web links and a paper that are associated with today's slide presentation. Hope you can download it and refer to that if you have any question or want to know more on detail. Thanks for listening and participation.
All right. Thank you, Hunsik. And I will mention that the references that Hunsik has listed here are also available for download, as well as the presentation and a number of other materials available for download from the seminar site website, including some case studies and a look at applying this particular approach in island settings, a presentation that I uploaded there, and a couple of reports that describe ecotoxicity applications of this particular approach. And so are we going to have some time for questions now?
We are now past 12 noon, but if folks are available to stay on the line and willing to, and the speakers are available, I think we certainly should entertain questions from both the folks listening through their teleconference lines as well as typing in questions through the instant messaging service. So Matt, why don't you go ahead and mediate that?
Dave, do you have questions there from the instant messaging?
Yeah, there's one from Greg Kimball, WSP Environment and Energy, who asks, Hunsik, have you compared the leaching screening levels developed by your method to the EPA regional screening levels, EPA Region 3, 6, and 9 tables, for leaching from soil to groundwater? Are your levels higher or lower in general?
I'm not familiar with the Region 3 screening level, so I really cannot tell. I will look at the table and then I can tell you, but I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. I'm familiar with them, Hunsik, and I can say they're almost consistently way lower than screening levels are, and that's...
Which one is lower than the others?
We're lower than yours and lower than mine for leaching. And it's because they use a very simplistic leaching model that's way overestimates in most people's opinion impacts the groundwater.
So the Washington State approach is, predicted the higher level of the cleanup level, protective level for the groundwater.
I'd say they're more realistic, Washington State, than ours are.
All right, yeah. It's good to hear, yeah.
That's it for the online questions.
Hey, you know, Matt, or can I jump in real quick? This is Roger again. Just a few questions may have come up on mine. One is that I guess Hawaii is also looking at carbon range guidance similar to Hunsik's. The Air Force here has already done it. If someone wants to use our surfer and our screening levels, one thing to be aware of is that for vapor and levels probably aren't adequately conservative for areas of the country where buildings are heated and have poor ventilation than Hawaii does or West Coast of California. So you probably won't at least divide our screening levels by two. And then the third thing is, how about all these risk assessments, including a lot I did back in the 90s, where we didn't really look at TPH, do we need to go back and reopen all these cases now? similar like we may have had to do for vapor intrusion for chlorinated solvents. And I'd say definitely not. In most cases, petroleum contamination, if you clean up the stuff that stinks, the gross contamination, at the same time you're addressing, you know, direct exposure and vapor intrusion hazards adequately. And also the toxicity factors that are being used for TPH now, most toxicologists I talk to seem to think they're excessively conservative, at least in order of magnitude. You're probably not going to get significant, you know, vapor intrusion hazards, say, without being able to really smell it, having odor issues, or even taste in drinking water. And you're also, you're unlikely for vapor intrusion to exceed background TPH impacts inside of buildings, unless you're sitting on a heavily contaminated site. So some of the really heavily contaminated sites, harbors, old refineries, where just, they didn't clean up everything, you may want to go get some soil gas data. But we still insist on including TPH in our risk assessments, just so we know what's there, and especially for redevelopment purposes in the future, just to flag potential concerns before someone starts to go into construction. That's all I have to say.
There is one more online question that has just come in, unless there's other phone questions. Okay, I'll go then. It says two different ranges of TPH soil cleanup levels were presented. Rogers' talk shows 500 to 600 milligrams per kilogram. Hunseek's talk shows 1,300 to 288 milligrams per kilogram. What are the keys for this difference? From C.Y. Yang at California DTSC.
This is Roger again. I'd say for gasoline, we use a hazard quotient of 0.5. I think Hunseek was using 1, and he must be using a little bit different and probably more realistic mixture for gasoline, aliphatics, and aromatics. We just assume, like you pointed out before, 100% C11, C22 aromatics. For diesel fuel, it's probably something similar, but I'd wonder about saturation limits once you start to get up to a couple of thousand ppm TPH diesel in soil. You see anything else, Hunseek?
Yeah, I really don't know what makes it the difference, but I think we break it down more detailed and more 12 different fractions and then assign for each carbon fraction with a different toxicity value. So that might give us some different number. And also the endpoints, the hazard index numbers we assign for 1, but I think your case assigned for 0.5 to make it a little difference.
It is more conservative.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that that it's important to realize that these are screening levels, and if you have a site, you know, that varies appreciably or varies greatly from the sort of simple exposure scenarios that are used to create these screening levels, you know, you need to go in and do some site-specific evaluation, and that's the nice thing about Hunseek's spreadsheet is it allows you to do site-specific evaluation, do a fractional analysis of the petroleum hydrocarbons that are actually present at your site. So you get a site-specific mixture, a site-specific composition of your petroleum hydrocarbons. Then using these surrogate toxicities for each of the hydrocarbon ranges, you're able to create or to evaluate a site-specific toxicity that you're dealing with. And in looking at that, the toxicity can change pretty dramatically as these petroleum hydrocarbons weather and the composition shifts to the heavier end members.
Yep. And we allow that approach in Hawaii. Very few people have done it. It's more of a cost issue. And also, at some point, once you start getting above a couple of thousand ppm TPH anyway, then toxicity no longer drives the need for cleanup or at least long-term management. It becomes a leaching hazard or gross contamination hazard or the site's generating lots of methane or other vapors.
Apple-based,
yeah.
So the larger sites is probably worth it, smaller not.
Those comments lead into one more question that came in from Bob Moore in the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. He says, this is from Hunseek's presentation, he says, EPH analysis, do you account for the non-hydrocarbon fractions removed by the silica gel cleanup?
I don't know the detail about the analysis. So you can, he or she can send an email and then I'll pass on to the Manchester State Lab.
This is Matt. I can speak to that a little bit.
Okay.
The silica gel cleanup is something that's used typically to remove polar compounds, and so the concept is that these polar compounds are organic materials that are present in the environment, maybe organic acids, things like this, that may create sort of a false positive for a petroleum hydrocarbons analysis. So the silica gel is used to pull those reactive compounds out. And I think that that's appropriate, particularly in environments where you know you have a lot of organic material. One of the examples that I have posted to the website is from Johnston Atoll, which is, what, about 800 miles south of Hawaii or something like that, Roger?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
And it's a little rock out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean where we had a chemical weapons incineration facility. And so we took care of all the dioxins and all the problems associated with that, but we still had a lot of petroleum because this was also an airstrip and a refueling facility during Second World War. And when we went in and we did the TPH analysis there, we definitely did silica gel cleanup because there's so much bird guano that they actually were, they would sail from Hawaii to mine bird guano for phosphate in the past. So silica gel was a necessity in that particular instance. In environments where you have less naturally occurring organic material deeper in the subsurface in your typical aquifer, I'm not sure silica gel cleanup is always warranted, and in fact, I think it may be removing some of the daughter products that are present from the breakdown of the petroleum hydrocarbons. So it's kind of a site-by-site judgment call as to whether the silica gel is really an appropriate thing to do or not, and it's based on the amount of naturally occurring organic materials at the individual site. Again, Hunsik has more information on this, and I'd be happy to chat with you more about it offline. And you can also do a search online for Dawn Zemo, D-A-W-N-T-E-M-O, and she's written a number of articles on this particular issue and is quite knowledgeable.
Hey, Matt, this is Roger again, and we went through this issue also with Dawn Zemo, and he runs silica gel cleanup on some of the old petroleum releases here. You may take out 80% of the junk that's there. We didn't disagree that it wasn't TPH, but we want to know, is this stuff toxic, all these phenols and stuff? You know, would you still drink this groundwater if it's full of
yeah,
all this?
Yeah, and I just don't always buy the argument that it's naturally occurring organic material. I think it may be breakdown products, other products from the petroleum hydrocarbons, and you're fooling yourself by doing the silica gel cleanup and assuming that you've actually evaluated the risk at the site.
Right, we had Don Wright actually...
We generally allow to use the silica gel to analyze the pH.
So, Matt, I'll send you a paper that Don Zemo wrote, a white paper for the Air Force here, because we want to know what you're taking out of the groundwater or out of the sample if you run it through silica gel cleanup. And her conclusion was she actually came up with some, you know, toxicity factors for all the stuff that gets taken out for silica gel cleanup, and then makes the case on whether or not that needs to be considered in risk assessments, which in most cases it doesn't. Your TPH that's left would still drive any at least toxicity-based risk. It all comes down again, too, to sort of gross contamination issues. At least know what you're dealing with if you leave it in place and don't clean it up. I can send you that white paper to post on the webpage.
I'd like to take a look at it, but again, and you know, Hunsik popped in there and said that they do allow the silica gel cleanup, and it's somewhat of a fine point in that with petroleum hydrocarbons, the material that's there, the gross contamination is probably really going to be driving the cleanup anyway.
Well, I have had two more online questions. Are there other people on the phone? If not, I'll go ahead with these.
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. This is from Greg Kimball, WSP Environment Energy in Minneapolis. He says, is a spreadsheet calculation method accepted by other states and agencies? I just heard Hawaii say yes.
The spreadsheet calculation method accepted by other states and agencies, Absolutely, yeah. In for screening levels, is what we're talking about here. There's, California is using these spreadsheet approaches. HunSeq obviously using it in Washington. There's other states, I can't name them all off the top of my head. Guam, Saipan, American Samoa.
Oregon.
Do you know of any others, HunSeq, Roger?
Oregon.
There's a ton of states that have, you know, slightly different approaches, maybe, but
Arizona,
similar spreadsheets. Massachusetts, Wisconsin, Michigan.
Again, these are screening level spreadsheets to give you, you know, this is the risk-based corrective action approach where you use fairly straightforward exposure scenarios, assuming the contamination is you know, relatively close to the surface, and you know, you're using fairly conservative exposure parameters. If you need to go to some more detailed site-specific analysis, these spreadsheets can help, but you may need to do other types of evaluation also.
Okay, and the last one I have in here is from Larry Frobe from Shaw Environmental Corporation in Irvine, California, and he asks, is it intended that TPH hazard be added with that for other COCs in a cumulative risk assessment? It seems that the uncertainties in the tox values for the multiple fractions will drive the uncertainty in the total hazard. How would that be addressed? By separating TPH evaluation from other COCs?
Well, this is Roger. I'd say, you have to include it because it's one of the main constituents of contamination you're looking at. But you note the uncertainty. And then I wouldn't use TPH for any more than a screening level, just cleaning up, you know, 90% of petroleum contaminated sites, you just go out and clean up what stinks and you're done. But when you start going to more detailed risk assessment, that's where you really need to go to the carbon range fraction approach that HunSeq's talking about and not just look at the default TPH toxicity packages that we use.
In fact, that TPH spreadsheets that we adopted, especially Washington adopted, we have a 27 component that including 12 carbon fractions. So which means we have another 12 or 14 indicator chemical like BTX and CPHs and other MTB and other chemical along with the 12 carbon fractions. So we included all together and then calculated to meet the final cleanup level, cleanup goal of the risk hazard index equal to 1. So we put together, you know, one pot.
You know, one thing in Hawaii too, which is probably common in every other state, is, you know, we acknowledge up front that in most cases you're not going to get every pocket of contaminated soil out of place. You may even have to leave a lot of contaminated soil in place, but
true.
At least this way you document up front what your environmental hazards and risks are, and then put together a good long-term management program for the site. If nothing else, just to make sure when someone goes in and redevelops it, they know what they're getting into and before they go out there, and they can put this in their budget for dealing with it in their management plans.
And I think it's also important to realize that a lot of these evaluations, that particularly one that HunSeq Park has put together for Washington, separates out the fractional analysis of total petroleum hydrocarbons, and it's all considered to be non-carcinogenic risk. All the carcinogens are dealt with separately and assumed to be remediated, you know, and considered for remediation separately. Is that correct, HunSeq?
It depends. But we recommended put it in one spot together, like a benching. Some states, they consider only the carcinogenicity, but we consider the non-carcinogenicity and as well as carcinogenicity out of the benching. So we included those type of chemicals included in one of the fractions.
Right. The non-carcinogenic effects of these other compounds are included in the TPH evaluation, but then the carcinogenic effects are considered separately, correct?
We recommended to put it together.
Okay.
Oh, separately, right. That's true, yeah. Carcinogenic separately. Yeah. True.
Okay.
Okay.
Any other questions, Dave?
There's nothing else from the internet lines.
Anyone with questions on the phone line? Okay, having heard no additional questions,
Matt, this is Charles Maurice. I wanted to let everyone know that 2 weeks from today, on June 30th, same time, same website, Clue-In website, we will be having the next seminar in the Cumulative Risk Assessment Seminar Series. It will be presented by Dr. Mary White from EPA Region 5 in Chicago, and she will be talking about the CREAM, which is a critical ecosystem assessment model, the landscape level model, which combines chemical and non-chemical factors across a large six-state region of the upper Midwest of the United States. So everyone is welcome to return in a couple of weeks.
Other than that, I'd like to thank our speakers, Roger Brewer and Hunsik Park. I'd ask everyone to give a big round of applause, but I don't think that'll work. Good information. Thank you all for attending.